Welcome to episode 210 of the Ski Podcast, and thanks for joining us, listener. Today, we're going to be discussing the ski resort of Baquera in Spain and finding out about the country in the world that is growing faster than any other in terms of skiing, and that is China. Now, my name's Ian Martin. I'd like to introduce my guest today. I'm delighted to welcome two first-timers to the show this week. Firstly, we have freelance journalist Gabby Le Breton. Hi, Gabby. How are you today?
Hello. Very good. Thank you. Lovely to be here for the first time, as you say.
And whereabouts are you?
I'm in deepest, darkest rural Kent. Yeah, near the coast, surrounded by apple trees.
Okay, sounds wonderful. I can never remember if I'm a Kentish man or a man of Kent. It's to do with whether you're north or south of the Medway, isn't it? I think I'm a Kentish man myself. Excellent. And my second guest today, also a first time on the show, I'm delighted to welcome Justin Downs, president of Axis Leisure, who are major players in the development of skiing in China. Hi, Justin. How are you?
I'm good, Ian. Good to meet you. Thanks for having me on.
Remind us where you are today.
Well, I couldn't be any further different than where Gabby is. I'm in bright and sunny Beijing, about 5 kilometers from Tiananmen Square. So right in the thick of the action.
Right. Okay. Well, I mean, I did know you were there. And thank you very much for fitting this into your schedule. Because what time of the day is it for you?
It's 6 o'clock. So not too bad. Yes.
Excellent. I really appreciate that. One question I always like to start off with my guests, is to ask you when you skied or snowboarded last. Gabby, when was that for you?
I was in Swiss Alps and Andermatt. 25th of March was my last ski day of the season. Yeah, it was a funny few days. It was very stormy and cold, and then got really hot in the afternoons, got nice and slushy. So yeah, it was a suitable end to my season. Great, excellent fun.
Well, I'm a big fan of Andermatt. I've been there several times in the last few years. For a little while, Switzerland Tourism was sponsoring the podcast, and you may know that I had Mike Gore, who's the CEO of Vail Resorts in Andermatt, on the podcast in episode 204, and that is a really interesting story. Evidently, it's been a couple of years now since Vail Resorts purchased Andermatt. Did you see any evident changes at all that, you know, might hint at that partnership?
I think the most evident changes I noticed were the presence of Americans, because I've never encountered them in Andermatt before. So that was very interesting. I mean, brilliantly, I was waiting for a bus with a chap who's actually from Seattle, and I was asking him how he found it, and he said he found it absolutely terrifying. He said, "I never know if I'm going to follow a route and fall off a mountain or end up in a really cute little village," which I thought was quite funny. I've known the resort since I was 8, so there have been a lot of changes, obviously, in that time. It's developing in mostly positive ways. I think the infrastructure on the mountain has benefited from the Vail Resorts investment, clearly. And there's a new cotton club that's just opened, run by a really eccentric Norwegian couple, which is, I think, going to really set a whole new scene for the resort in terms of glamour and après and fine dining.
I mean, it's interesting as well to hear you mentioned the number of Americans that you noticed in Andermatt. And certainly because of the Epic Pass and the Icon Pass, I think we've been seeing more Americans coming to Europe. And I actually watched a video, I'll put a link to it in the show notes, but they were talking about the differences they found between the States and Europe and how horrified they were about the fact you could kind of ski anywhere. No one stops you skiing down, the backcountry areas or even closed piece, for example.
Yeah, it's very unsanitized, shall we say, in comparison with the US, for sure.
Yeah, and that applies to lift queues as well, as they point out in there. But I'll put a link into show notes about that. Justin, what about yourself? When were you last on snow?
Well, not quite as glamorous as Andermatt, I must say, but I was in one of our indoor ski domes in Wuhan, which is south central China, last Friday, so less than 1 week ago, which is always an interesting, you know, you're not going to fall off any cliffs or go anywhere where you're going to get lost in one of these indoor ski domes, but they're quite the going concern, as I'm sure you've heard about in regard to Chinese ski industry development. Last weekend, I was actually up for the final weekend of our in our Olympic cluster, the venue for the freestyle skiing events for the 2022 games. I did the last day of skiing up there. very mild. I think it was 17 degrees Celsius at the time. So definitely time for the season to close.
That is very interesting. We're talking about China in more detail a little bit later on. I'm particularly interested in those indoor slopes as well, because I know that they are growing very fast as well. But as you both referred to, the season is drawing to a close, but it's still possible to ski in a few resorts. And I've asked a couple of our regular contributors to send us in a snow report. So let's hear from them.
Hi, everyone. It's Andy over in St. Anton on Tuesday, the 23rd of April. With a split resort weather and snow update. Split because St. Anton is now actually closed for the winter, but the last week of the season, the 14th to the 21st of April, was pretty phenomenal. The resort closed on the 21st, Sunday the 21st, after the famous Weisse Rausch, the white noise race down the mountain, being made famous over many, many years now, was actually done for the first time in a long time in dumping powder snow. Which was quite a new experience for all the racers. But between this 14th and 21st of April, the snow has been pretty incredible. Over 70 centimetres of fresh snow fell throughout that week, leaving two or three of probably the best powder days of the whole winter. You couldn't tell if it was the middle of January or the end of April. It really was that spectacular and that special. Temperatures were cold. It was quite stormy. Visibility wasn't great, but the snow conditions were fantastic. Which really made a super end for everybody who was left in resort. But as I said, resort closed on the 21st. So what do you do when the resort closes? You go to the next resort that's open, and that was Ischgl, for 45 minutes down the valley. Everybody's probably heard of Ischgl for their famous closing parties. And indeed, the Black Eyed Peas are doing the big closing party on top of the mountain on the 30th. So I was lucky enough to spend the whole day today skiing in fresh powder snow. It's dumped just as much snow there as it has in St. Anton. It's a fantastic ski area in Ischgl. The weather was very mixed today. It was quite cloudy, so higher up around the sort of like 2,500 and above, it was very, very cloudy, very misty fog. You couldn't really see your hand in front of your face. But once you dropped down under sort of 2,400, 2,300 metres, the visibility was a lot better. Skiing between the trees was superb. And in the pockets of sunshine, when the sun shined out, it really was quite glorious. It was about minus eight, which is would seem quite cold, but it didn't feel cold at all until the wind blew. But the snow throughout the whole resort was superb. Right the way down back to the village, you were skiing fresh lines, fresh tracks pretty much all day. So in terms of April skiing, this was absolutely phenomenal. I can't remember many past Aprils being this good, but certainly for the last couple of years, April skiing has been absolutely tremendous. It's the way forward, it's the future. The resort's quiet, it's lovely. The slopes are quiet, there's no lift queues. It really is a dreamy time to ski. But that's me over and out for the last report of the season. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you, Ian, for all the updates. And hope you all have a great summer. Cheers.
Hi, Ian and Ski Podcast listeners. This is Susie here out in Chamonix. Winter has returned again with snow falling regularly last week down to valley level and at least 50 to 60 centimetres of new snow above 2,000 metres. There were some excellent powder days last week at Grandmonte. Wednesday and Thursday in particular were fantastic. The sun even made an appearance, and the days just got better and better. This week, so far, the weather is pretty mixed. It's cloudy with morning frost and a cold north wind, with light snow falling down as low as 600 to 800 metres in places. We have the Grandmonte ski area still open until Sunday the 5th of May, so nearly 2 weeks left of the season. Today, the pistes were skiing well at Grandmonte, mostly cold snow on well-groomed pistes, with only a few patches of ice and Saharan stands still poking through. Off-piste, there was about 5 to 10 centimetres of new snow from last night and this morning, light cold powder on top of the previous snow, so excellent conditions off-piste. It's not possible to ski the piste to the bottom of the Grandmonte, you do have to download in the cable car now. With the large volume of snow at altitude, the ski touring is still great around the Grandmonte and also from the Aiguille Midi and the Skyway lifts on the Italian side. Coming up to celebrate the final day of the season is the free ride day at Grandmonte on Sunday the 5th of May. This year's theme is La Préhistoire, or Dress Up as a Dinosaur. There'll be music, the usual water slide and other festivities to enjoy. Wishing you all a great last couple of weeks of the season. Thanks, Ian. Bye.
Hi, this is Alex from Tip Top Ski Coaching here in Les Deux Alpes with the latest snow report. Temperatures are wintry, minus 12 without the wind chill on the glacier this morning, and cold in resort as well, below freezing. We've had fresh snow every other day for the last few days, and we're due more fresh snow tonight and tomorrow, with temperatures staying low. The actual snow conditions on the piste are wintry, perfect corduroy piste all the way down to 2,600, even in the Bellecombe area, actually, and will be even better after a bit more snowfall again tomorrow. So what a fantastic end of the season. It seems winter doesn't want to leave us. So we'll be enjoying this last week of the full season and then starting our glacier season, where we will be skiing through till the 7th of July here in Les Deux Alpes.
Now, Alex mentioned that skiing isn't stopping in Les Deux Alpes yet. Regular listeners will know I was in Les Deux Alpes earlier this month. And if you listen to our last episode, 209, you'll have heard my interview with Anthony Guzman from the lift company Aeon about the new Jondry lift there. Now, while we were sitting down, I also asked him about their summer season. So let's have a listen to that.
So again, I'm with Anthony Guzman, sales and marketing director from SATA and Aeon, who run Les Deux Alpes. We were just talking about the summer season that you have here, because one of the great advantages of having a glacier is that you can ski, I mean, I guess notionally all year round, but you're going to have, well, I guess roughly a 2 month summer season. Yes. And it's going to effectively start as soon as the winter's finished, right?
Yes. April 29th. The glacier will be available for ski clubs, but also for the public until July 7th.
Okay. And during that period, ski clubs as well, but you know, anyone can come along and like buy a lift ticket for the day.
Yes, absolutely. It will be, the glacier is the ski area available, but it's really open to everyone.
And I was up there today and I could see the kickers over to my right hand side as I was going up the T-bar. That would be the snow park that's open up there. Not my sort of thing. but good for someone as well. And you do a lot of work kind of just now to move the snow around to protect the glacier.
Yes, the goal is to create a layer that actually protects the glacier, and it's working.
When the skiing closes on the 7th of July, then your focus moves towards mountain biking and hiking,
and
right?
Hiking, absolutely. And then we will be open until the end of August, 1st of September.
Actually. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've seen the lower slopes, the snow's gone there, and the people who I was with today saying, well, what's that there? And I said, that is a mountain bike track, you know, not the sort of one that we would go down, but you know, some incredible turns and berms through there. And I saw in the woods over to the right, there's some jumps and things like that well. Yeah,
we opened the mountain biking activity June 15th.
Right. Okay.
So it will be there's a transition between skiing and mountain biking.
There's lots of mountain bike races and competitions here in summer. I know there's trail running races as well. And actually, a little while ago, I interviewed Mathieu Blanchard, the ultra runner, who told me that one of the reasons he bases himself here isn't just because he can run around the park, there's a crown jewel. It's because he can do all the other activities. You know, he's like 5 minutes from his door. And I've been here in summer. It's great fun.
That's really interesting. Skiing's still available through to July in Les Deux Alpes. Now, normally our feedback section comes later in the show, but as we're on Les Deux Alpes now, I thought I'd address an email from Mike Greenland. He said, I was surprised that Monsieur Guzman thought the new lift wouldn't lead to crowding, as my impression is there are already too many beds in the resort. He goes on to say that I've skied for over 50 years in all the major resorts in Europe, and I felt this, Les Deux Alpes, was a crowded ski area, and it wasn't even half term or Easter. Well, thanks for that feedback, Mike. I mean, it's interesting to hear what you think. All I can say is it's not been my experience. And I've been there at Easter a couple of times. I can't speak for half term. People who know Les Deux Alpes a bit better, I guess probably in the Crete area where most of the lessons take place, it can get a bit busy. And there's a funnel with a blue run coming down to Jondry too. But otherwise, my experience is there's lots of space. And here's my tip for anyone going to Les Deux Alpes, especially if you're looking for space, head down to the Fay area or down to Signal off the glacier. Both of those runs are generally empty, big and wide. One final piece of news. I'd like to give Messy Weekend a shout out. When I was in Verbier, can't remember what episode that was now, but I'll put a link to it in the show notes. I lost my goggles. It was entirely my own fault. I didn't secure them properly on the ski out from the off piece we did. But I reached out to them and they sent me some new ones. So I really want to give them a huge shout out. And for what it's worth, I also do my trail running in messy weekend sunnies. So I highly recommend them. I actually did the South Downs Way 50 at the weekend. So I'm feeling it a little bit right now. Finally, I was lucky enough to get another gift sent through this week. It's a visor from a brand called Valon. It's a very retro style. They're a Swedish brand. To be honest with you, it's not actually my thing, but my wife is very keen. She's going to be wearing it this summer, if and when the sun ever comes out. If you'd like to know what it looks like, you can see a pic in the show notes. It's sold out at the moment, but I think it's coming back into stock soon. Gabby, you look like you knew that brand, Valon. They also do sunnies and goggles as well.
They do. They've kindly sent me a pair of goggles, and I love them. They're absolutely brilliant. It's a really cool brand, isn't it? Style and substance.
Have you looked at these visors at all then?
I have, a bit like you perhaps. I can't quite see myself utilizing one, so I didn't take up the kind offer to trial one. But yeah, I know people swear by them. Tennis, I think they're very handy playing.
Exactly. Tennis. Exactly. They're very Bjorn Borg style. I tell you what, Gabby, let's move out of the Alps and completely and move down to the Pyrenees, because one of the reasons I wanted to have you on the show is because recently you went out to the Spanish Pyrenees, and regular listeners will know I visited a lot of the resorts in the French Pyrenees, but I've never covered the Spanish Pyrenees. I did actually go to Baquera a long time ago. I think it was probably 1988. So long ago that at that time they had a one-man chair. I imagine it's very different now. So I'm really pleased to have you on, Gabby, to tell us about it. When were you out there?
I was out there, gosh, was it late February or early March, thereabouts. I was colossally lucky. I got there and everyone was saying, oh my God, it's the best day of the season. So we arrived, it was chucking it down with snow, all the great things. And then it was a bluebird day the next day, and then it snowed some more and we had another bluebird day. So I have a completely unrealistic view of skiing in Baquera, but I think I've wanted to go there for the best part of 20 years. So this was a very long overdue visit, and I was blown away by the scale of the terrain, the quality of the grooming, and the accessibility of the off-piste. I was so impressed by that, because as you'll know from so many European resorts, might have vast off-piste kind of backcountry terrain, but you have to hike or tour or ski or, you know, whatever it is to access it. But in Baquera, you just literally step off a lift and it's right there. It's extraordinary. And then you ski down and step onto another lift.
Firstly, I wonder if we could just clarify, you know, where it is. People understand the Pyrenees, you know, that ring, that ridge of mountains that goes across from the Atlantic to the Mediterranean. It's on the eastern side. Where did you fly into? Where's the best place to access it from?
The best place to access it is not where I flew into. So the best place for transfers is Toulouse. And from there, it's about a two-hour, very scenic road transfer. So Baquera sits literally on the border of France. So it's an autonomous little community. A bit like Andorra, it's just to the west of Andorra. We flew into Barcelona, which was very special because you fly, you know, into that city with the beach and the sea, and then it's a quite hefty four-hour transfer, which is, again, very scenic and perfect if you want to bookend a ski trip with a city break or a beach break. But if you're just going to ski, then it would be advisable to fly into Toulouse. So Baquera sits in the Val d'Aran, which in Occitan means the valley of the valley. It's a fantastically scenic kind of cleft that runs up towards the French border, spanning 35 miles. It's got 33 little villages dotted along it, each of which has its own Romanesque church and little old slate and timber buildings. It's all engulfed by national parks, so you get a tremendous wealth of wildlife. Brown bears and eagles and vultures and you name it, they're all hovering around there. So it's purely as a cultural and so visual feast. It's a special trip, even without the skiing.
And you mentioned the off piste, but what about the actual piste themselves? How many? Do you want to give us an idea of the kind of size of the area in terms of the number of piste and lifts, etc.?
It's very impressive. And I was surprised by the piste skiing. 165 kilometers of pistes. So that puts it in comparison with, that's more actually than Courchevel, than Grindelwaldbahnen, more than Sölden. In terms of skiable terrain, which North American users might be more familiar with, it's got 2,273 hectares, which is bigger than Vail and bigger than Aspen. So there are 165 kilometers of piste, most of which are intermediate. And there are 5 kilometers of ungroomed itineraries. So it's a really impressive spread. It's all linked by, I think, 38 lifts, which have, as you say, come on since your one-man chair. And the ski area spans 5 mountains. So it's quite spread out, which enables you to have a feeling of traveling between the different areas and experience different mountains, different angles, depending on the time of day and the sun and the angles, you can pick your terrain accordingly.
And what's the kind of altitude of the resort and highest points?
Bakeda and Beret are two individual settlements, as it were. It was a purpose-built resort built in 1964 by the Spanish. And Bakeda sits at 1,500 and Beret sits at 1,850. Remarkably similar to Courchevel. It tops out at Cap de Bakiva at 2,610. For a point of reference, Courchevel tops out at 2,740. So it's quite comparable in terms of stats for Courchevel, in terms of altitude, size, grooming, I would say, even as well. But it's a much more homespun kind of vibe to it all. It's definitely, you have the whole Latin, Spanish kind of chill thing. Everyone's very attractive and wearing beautiful ski kit. They're very good skiers. It is definitely a resort where everyone skis really well, which is, quite fun because you're inspired by seeing these people kind of whooping off cliffs and everything. It's like, it feels more like a Verbier or an Engelberg in that way, but with that laid back kind of Latin vibe going on.
Okay, I mean, that's kind of interesting. It's not kind of how I visualized it. And you're making quite a few comparisons with Courchevel there. I seem to remember, when I went back in the day, one of the big things they used to say is this is where the royal family went. Is it full of, she clientele like that? And, are there Michelin star restaurants and things like you get in Courchevel?
There is definitely that. Yeah, the Spanish family still come. They have a very subtle, very low-key, you wouldn't know it until someone points it out to you, a little kind of enclave there. They still come. And they've come since the very beginning. So they were there from 1964. They very much their entourage, as it were. The Spaniards who like to be seen are there for sure. So there's like a Fuselp store. There are pretty glamorous shops. There's a Lionel Messi hotel with a really incredible restaurant there. There's a Veuve Clicquot champagne bar on the pistes, which sells the most Veuve of any place in the whole of Spain. Even though it only has a 3-month season, it still sells more per year than anywhere else. There is definitely that. There's that kind of vibe, but it's not overpowering, as it were, or as homogenous as the likes of Courchevel.
Right, and you compared it to Verbier and Engelberg, so I'm guessing there's more of a kind of core type of skier who goes there as well, but you said the pistes are mainly intermediate, so it works for families.
Yeah, 100% works for families. Yeah, and lots of, I didn't experience so much, but I know Peter Hardy, who I'm sure has been on your podcast, he's the ski writer extraordinaire, and Tom Robbins, who's the Financial Times kind of travel editor. They've both experienced this, the way that the resort tends to be very quiet in the mornings because everyone's out until like midnight, including the kids and all the family. Then if you get up early, you have this bonus of like really quiet mornings without the hordes of people there.
Yeah, for sure. I seem to recall that when we used to go, we went on a couple of camping holidays with the kids to Spain. And you could tell when we first arrived, we were the weird British people who were having dinner kind of 6 o'clock in the evening. And then as the holiday went on, we gradually transitioned to eating later and later and later and later, as they do in Spain. You mentioned the backcountry side of things as well. When I've only heli-skied in two places in my life, and one of them was in Baqueira back in the day, principally because it was an incredibly good value compared with everyone else. Is that still an option out there?
It's still an option. It's a smallish tenure. It's not on a scale of, you know, British Columbia or something. I think it's a 400 kilometer square tenure, but it's exclusive and they only run one chopper a day. So if you choose to go heli skiing there, you will have that entire tenure just to your group. And by all accounts, I mean, yeah, if you read Tom Robbins' feature about heli skiing in Baqueira and the FT, you know, it sounds magical. You do these drops, you ski down to these remote little villages or hamlets, and you just eat kind of traditional food with a dog lying by the fire. I mean, it must be magical. I would have loved to, but I genuinely did not need to, because the accessible terrain that we experienced was just mind blowing. It was brilliant, and we did a shortish hike to ski down into a little village, and that in itself was magical. It was, the guide we had is a female guide called Laya, who's known as like one of the best skiers in Baqueira. She runs a little ski school. She lives there, and she just took us on. She called it our adventure day, and we just lapped all these runs and descents. It was magic.
Outside of the Veuve Clicquot bar, would you say it represents good value, pretty good value compared with, let's say, the French and Swiss Alps?
100%. Yeah. The Veuve bar is not cheap. Messi's place is definitely not cheap. But you know, you can get. I had a Iberian steak, acorn fed, you know, organic, on the mountain for 20 euros, which I think is really good value. And like the bar at the base of the main ski area, pints of beer cost just under 5 euros, and the lift pass is also, it's 300 euros for a 6-day pass, which, you know, is less than, gosh, certainly less than the likes of Solden. I think Val Cenis was the only one that was vaguely comparable in terms of price from my research. So yeah, it's good value across the board. Ski rental is less. It's all less.
Oh, okay. Well, it sounds great. I have been there before, but that doesn't mean that it shouldn't be added to my list of places to go and visit. So I really appreciate you for sharing that visit with us, Gabby, and helping listeners find out more about it. If it's okay, I'd like to move on to Justin now. Justin, you've joined us from China. We can tell from your accent, I guess, that you're not Chinese. You've had a quite long background in the ski industry. I wondered if I could just take you back, because where are you from originally?
Well, my story is very complicated. So for the benefit of my parents, I should say that I'm from Australia. But for the benefits of my career, I should say that I'm Canadian.
And you mentioned Australia, you know, as well as what you're doing now in China. You kind of started off in ski area management in Australia. Were you running Hotham at one time?
No, I started my career in Whistler, actually, as an 18-year-old, just in the parking lot. That was the only job I could get, was a parking lot attendant, and kind of worked my way through every conceivable position. Ended up in management and then in the development side of the business. So I did 10 years in Whistler, then I went to Panorama, which was also owned by IntraWest, which was the owner of Whistler at the time, and was their head of resort operations. Was there for a couple of years, and then I went and started Kicking Horse, which is on most big mountain skiers' bucket list places to go. So I was the first employee and general manager of that project, and built it pretty similar to what it is still today. Not much development since I left in 2005. But I was there for 5 years, and then I went to Australia for 2 years.
Right. Okay. And how did that transition from being, you know, from managing ski areas in recognized countries, let's say, move towards founding Access Leisure and getting involved with the Chinese market?
Yeah, like it's all by chance. I mean, obviously, Canadian Rockies, I guess, okay, at least to us, is one of the holy grails of the ski destinations in the world. And Kicking Horse was certainly, and Whistler for that matter as well, a very recognizable and highly sought after places to go. I was at an age and had a young child at the time, so I didn't necessarily want to be just small town British Columbia. As exciting as it was, I was still young, so I thought there's still a world out there to explore. And Australia came knocking and gave me a chance to pick wherever I wanted to live in Australia, as long as I was willing to spend some time in the mountains. So I was looking after Mount Hotham primarily, but Falls Creek as well, based out of Melbourne, which was a fantastic experience and got my daughter to be a little bit more worldly. And now she's living in London. So, you know, she's a travel creature by default from following her parents around. The resorts in Australia ended up being sold and now actually are owned by Vail Resorts. So this name keeps on coming up. But my job disappeared when the new owners came in, and Intrawest was starting a division in China, ironically called Intrawest China. And that was to kind of bring North American resort development and operations know-how to China. So I was asked to come and join that team. So I was the senior VP of operations for the resort division. Unfortunately, that was a short-lived thing because we tried to do it during the global financial crisis. So people lost interest fairly quickly. And we realistically were about 10 years too early to try something as ambitious as what we were doing back in 2007, 2008. So I saw the Chinese industry in every aspect, not skiing solely, but anything to do with sport, wellness, tourism, recreation, anything to do with people getting out and enjoying their lives. This industry was going to boom, and there was no resources in the country that had any international expertise to support that. And I was here. So I thought, why not? I never thought I would be self-employed. I certainly never thought it would be in China. And here I am.
I mean, that's a very interesting journey to this point. I think it might be useful to give a bit of background about China and the state of skiing in China as well. Because, you know, for most people, they understand China, huge country, huge population. They might have seen, you know, the Beijing Winter Olympic Games, but they probably don't have any idea of the scale of skiing in China. And I have read some of the stats. I mean, you mentioned that indoor slope in Wuhan that you skied in recently. I think I'm right in saying there's more indoor slopes in China than there are in the rest of the world combined.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, we have 50 that are, or 52 now, that are in operation. And at least as far as my research and our client network is concerned, there's another 12 in planning or in construction. So there is more indoor ski resorts, yes, than the rest of the world combined. And it still only represents about 8% of the total amount of ski destinations in the country. So we have a lot of outdoor destinations, more than 800 now. Your definition of a destination might not be the same as ours here, but anywhere where you can get pulled up a mountain or sit on a chair and then slide down is considered a destination here. But these 7 or 8% of the total amount of destinations being indoor in China actually represents 20% of the total visitation for the entire country's skier visits. So they're unbelievably important to the growth and introduction of the sport to Chinese.
Yeah, I mean, that is really interesting. There are lots of questions coming up in my mind. But okay, you talk about percentages of the total skier visits. So to give the listener kind of benchmark, I think the total number of skier days in the States is around 50 million. So what is it in China just now?
We don't have the data for this year yet. My prediction coming back to around February was that we were going to go around 31 million this year. So I still think that is a reasonable target when we see the final statistics come out. The last year's visits, which was still hampered a little bit by COVID, we hit just under 22 million. So, you know, we're seeing still significant growth percentage wise, and we still have a long way to go to get to North American numbers. But I believe that we'll be at that number and greater by 2025. So, you know, basically one more full year and we'll have the largest ski population in the world, but we also have kind of the largest population in general. So It's just a game of numbers.
You say it's a game of numbers. I mean, those are some huge numbers. You know, I think I topped the show, the introduction, with it's the fastest growing market. But you haven't worked that out. But it sounds like a sort of 45% growth in a single year. Is that
what you just said? No, that's pretty much it. So we're definitely, you know, we're definitely exceeding pre-pandemic numbers, which is not difficult. You know, we had the Olympic Games, which spurred things on. But over the past 10 years, Chinese skier visits have increased more than 300%. So it is the largest percentage-wise increase in the world. But, you know, starting from a small number, so it's, with a big population, it's kind of only got one way to go, which is up. But these numbers have still represents a very small percentage of the overall population. Most of them, you say most international people have no idea about skiing in China. Well, I can tell you still most Chinese people have no idea about skiing in China. So there's still a long pathway of people to get involved.
So in fact, you're talking about participation. Again, I think using the States as a benchmark, maybe 10, 11, 12% of people in the States are recognized as being skiers. So what would that participation level be in China? And what do you think, how much growth is there to come?
Well, I mean, look, we can be aggressive and confident and say that, you know, you look at Japan and Korea in their heydays, or Japan specifically, you're in the 20 percentile of participants involved with skiing or snowboarding. I mean, if China does that, then we're looking at, you know, a lot, 300 million people. You know, that's a lot. No, I believe that we can get in the 7 or 8% penetration market range. Like when I say we'll do 30 million skier visits, that's not 30 million individual visits. That's a cumulative number. But I still think that we're going to be in the tens of millions of participants in the coming 3 to 5 years.
Yeah, well, that is pretty amazing. So Access Leisure, you know, you're president of Access Leisure. You're involved in developing skiing in China. There's clearly, you know, an increasing demand. But how do you, you know, if I know you're working on like indoor centers and outdoor, you know, resorts or destinations, as you term them. How do you plan a ski resort if you can just start from scratch?
Well, obviously, you've got to find the right band of climate. So if you're an outdoor resort, and to be honest, most places in China rely solely on man-made snow. Although we do have resorts, especially in the northwest of the country, which get significant natural snowfall. But the majority of the skier visits fall in the northeast of the country, which is a very dry part. So you need to have good access to water resources, obviously. So finding the right climate, the climate range, you know, we have perfect snowmaking conditions. It's a very dry air, perfect for making snow, keeping water at the right temperatures. The terrain is suitable for holding snow for long periods of time. But basically, of course, we're looking for the right type of gradients of ski area, of mountains, to build the right type of trails that suit the market. And the majority of the market is still the beginner market. We're kind of grooming here the world's future skiers by teaching them how to ski indoors. Then they migrate to the smaller mountains by comparison to European mountains. And then eventually they're going to Japan, North America, and Europe. We've got quite significant environmental restrictions, believe it or not, in China. They're very, very sensitive to making sure that there's no degradation of the environment, not taking away farmland because there's lots of people to feed, not, you know, using water resources carelessly. Trees are a very, very expensive thing to get around in China, so removing trees is almost impossible. So you've got to kind of find these unique mountains that kind of don't require a lot of impact on the environment themselves, and then have a base area that allows you to build a real estate or, you know, transport accessibility and commercial activities like the Veuve Clicquot Bar or these types of things eventually will come here as well.
I mean, that is really interesting. Look, you know, I'm having so many thoughts as you're discussing. I mean, certainly we've mentioned, we keep referring back to Vail Resorts, but I think there are comparisons that can be made there. You know, one of the, a number of their acquisitions they've made have been these one hill resorts, you know, in places like Minnesota, et cetera, which they see as being their feeder resorts for everything else on the Epic Pass. And so the role of that indoor market is really important for bringing people to those ski resorts as well. And finding those locations. I'm guessing, evidently, you know, a key part of it is you need to be able to find that spot, but it needs to be close to like a certain amount of population, and they need to be able to get there. What about the kind of infrastructure? How does that work? Do you build it first and then get the infrastructure, or do you only build it if you've got roads and trains, etc., going there?
Well, if you had have asked me this question 10 years ago, it was backwards. So, you know, they would either be building some massive development in the middle of nowhere, no way to get there, or they built all the infrastructure and then nothing there once you get there. So now it seems to be happening a little bit more organically. And the government is driving all of this, and they want this development, just like Canada, just like Kicking Horse when I went to Golden in the late 90s to around 2000. This was a relatively poor, struggling, blue-collar town from logging and railway and this type of thing, and they needed tourism in order to keep the town alive, because these heavy industries were not going to be the thing to sustain the town. So the same thing is happening in China. It's all about the central government wants people to stop moving to the cities. They want them to develop their careers and their livelihoods and their families in these less urban environments. So having a population base nearby is not a problem in China, because, again, we've got lots of people. But yes, I mean, these places are remote, but the government is backing it up by building airports. High-speed rail is everywhere. So, you know, I mean, it used to take me to go to the Olympic cluster, which back in 2007 would have taken me 6-7 hours to get to. It's only 200 kilometers away. Now I can be there in an hour on the train. The government is putting this infrastructure in. They have to. And it's not just moving people to the ski resorts. It's actually moving people back to urban environments and allowing them to maintain some sort of a modern life and not just be stuck in the middle of nowhere. So it's all hand in hand.
It's really interesting. It sounds like a kind of real life way of playing a game like The Sims or something, where you're sticking in all and towns and everything around that. But you've mentioned the Olympic cluster several times, and obviously the Beijing Olympics. I'm guessing that has been pretty important in driving. You said awareness of skiing is relatively low, but that must have made a big difference.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely helped. But what I would say is, even before we were given the green light on the bid, the industry was already on an upward trajectory. It was definitely going places. But what the Olympics did was guarantee its longevity. Things don't necessarily happen easily here without the government's backing, either financial or just general blessing. And if they don't like something, then they'll make it very difficult for everybody. Like, golf course development is taboo subject in China, because it was a very dim view by the Chinese government because of previous ways of going about the development. So thankfully, the Chinese government obviously stood on its soapbox and said to the world that we're going to deliver the best Olympic Games, even though it was the middle of COVID. We're going to get people involved in this sport. And they're not backing down from that. So, of course, the Olympics shone the light on the industry for Chinese people. They now know more about it than they did before. But the government is now still saying we need to keep this thing going. It's not a white elephant of an industry, let alone a white elephant of a venue. So we want the smaller communities, the private developers, the state-owned enterprises, the public, to keep going with this. So they keep on making it easier for people to get involved.
That is really good to hear. There was a lot of talk when, you know, the London Olympic Games took place. It was going to vitalize or revitalize people's interest in sport, or young people's interest in sport. And maybe that hasn't particularly happened, but it sounds like that is happening over in China in relation to skiing and snowboarding. I wondered, there were some individuals who were very successful, Chinese individuals who were very successful at Beijing, like Eileen Gu and perhaps lesser known Su Yuming. How important were they, or are they, in the growth of Chinese skiing?
Oh, look, these kids, which is what they are rock stars. The one thing about the Chinese, let's just say, community as a whole, to put them under one category, is they love their celebrities, they love their sports stars. And when Chinese athletes or celebrities, which they kind of both are both, they're not just athletes, but they're celebrities, do well on a world stage, you're kind of like going to a Taylor Swift concert when you go to see Eileen Gu compete. Like, they're not even really watching the competition. There's only one person there as far as they're concerned. And it's like a concert. It's quite unbelievable. It's inspiring people to get in the sport. Like, these guys are really driving people's participation. There's no question about that. But the challenge for China is, okay, these guys and girls can't keep going forever. So what's the pipeline of the next generation of these types of influencers in the sport? So that's really what China's trying to do right now, is make sure that they're not just one-hit wonders as far as performance goes. There's a long runway of these celebrity athletes to keep people enthusiastic.
That sounds fascinating. I'm not surprised to hear those young skiers are influencing people. And I guess you're going to get more and more. If you think about Britain and our freestyle side of things, so many of those athletes started off skiing indoors, the fridge kids, as they were termed, who've then gone on to achieve Olympic success. So it seems likely to me that with the scale that China's got, that is going to work as well. There's evidently a lot of growth going on in China. What do you think the opportunities are? Obviously, your business is involved in building resorts, building indoor snow areas. But do you think there's opportunities for existing snow sport businesses within China?
Yes, absolutely. Look, I think it's just knowing who your target audience is. And, you know, it's such a diverse market, such a huge country just geographically. And there's very different types of businesses happening in different parts of the country. I mean, certainly on the education side of things, I also represent FIS, the International Ski Federation in China. So we're rolling out initiatives to ensure retention, but get people into competition, because that's FIS's end goal, is really about professional athletes and competitions. And, you know, we don't have coaches. We barely have team managers. So it's run like a Chinese kind of state-owned business, not really like a sporting association or anything like a more mature, sophisticated European or North American system might do. So, you know, we need the expertise to train the talent and to train people how to run these things as good businesses and long future pipelines of athletes to come. So yeah, on the educational side, both academic but also technical expertise, we definitely still need people and companies to come. China's developing a lot of its own technologies. So I would hazard a guess that if we have, say, 20 new detachable chairlifts going in this year, I would probably be able to confidently tell you that there are 20 domestically made detachable lifts. So not that there's many lift companies in the world anyway. It's a little bit of a monopoly or duopoly. You know, I think China's developing its technologies in snowmaking, grooming, and lifts. So the heavy infrastructure may be a little bit more of a challenge, but there's still opportunity because people still respect an international brand. On things like apparel and equipment, it's a huge, huge market. And yes, there's some big players already here in the market and doing very, very well. But like you were talking about your Swedish visor company, you know, you don't need a very big percentage of the market to do a very decent business here. You just have to find your niche. And I think people come in and go, I just want 5% of the market. Okay, well, you don't need 5%. You need 0.005%. And then you've got something meaningful. So don't try to be everything to everybody. Just come in and focus on one particular area or one particular aspect of the market. And I think that's where you need to look.
You know, all of that conversation, really fascinating. I think we're going to be revisiting China and following how the snow sports industry progresses over there over the next few years. And you know, if indeed it does become the largest ski market in the world as soon as 2025, that'd be amazing. Thanks so much, Justin, for sharing all of that information with us. I really appreciate it. Right, we're going to move towards the close now. A note on feedback. I enjoy all feedback about the show. I like to know what you think, especially about our features. So please do contact me on social at the Ski Podcast or by email theskipodcast@gmail.com. A few people have contacted me since the last episode. Oliver Ruttman said, really great episode with Xavier Delarue. He was also very complimentary about InSport in Engelberg. Quinn Resingo, possibly pronounced that wrong, said, I found your podcast recently and have enjoyed listening. He goes on to say he's an Icon pass holder based in Reno who skied in the Dolomites and Kitzbühel, but normally he skis in Mount Rose, which has 60 kilometers apiece and is never crowded. Now, he asked for recommendations in Europe that are similar. And Quinn, I'm going to refer you to Valsonie, which we covered in episode 205 and mentioned by Gabby a little earlier. One of those smaller resorts that actually has a decent amount of ski area and doesn't get overcrowded. Gabby, I wondered if you had any suggestions you wanted to add, that type of category of resort?
Yeah, I'm just my brother's just come back from a family holiday to Valsunni, and he loved it. He went with low expectations and returned with glowing praise. I mean, I love some of the Austrian resorts, the smaller Austrian resorts like kind of Westendorf and St. Johann, places like that have a lovely kind of vibe to them and access to obviously ginormous ski areas.
There are so many ski resorts in Europe. There are plenty to try, but there's a few suggestions for you, Quinn. Also had another message from Darren Jur. He said, congratulations on getting the new Vail Resorts executive of Andermatt on your show, which was episode 204. He goes on to ask why I didn't ask the obvious questions. One of them, will you kick out all the thriving mum and pop restaurants and replace them with bowls of chili and Gatorade? Well, Gabby, you were there. Those mum and pop restaurants haven't gone yet, have they?
They haven't gone yet. No, the old town of Andermatt is very little changed, certainly. Unfortunately, some of the hotels are standing empty, which is a bit sad. Yeah, there seems to be a feeling that people are trying to perhaps capitalise on the luxification of the resort as a whole, and therefore plans to luxify existing hotels are in place, but taking a while to come to fruition. On the mountain, the restaurants remain largely the same.
They hadn't really changed anyway. I find it unlikely they'll ever serve chili and Gatorade, but who knows, I could be proved wrong, but they have a very fine selection of restaurants and accommodation already in Andermatt. And we've had so much feedback about that episode 204 about Vail Resorts. I'm sure this story will run and run. But we're just going to move to close now. If you like the podcast, there are two things you can do to help. Just review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or you can subscribe so you never miss an episode. If you do review us, it helps other listeners find us. And if that doesn't suit you, I even appreciate a comment on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or YouTube at Ski Podcast and all of those. Now, there are now 215 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with. I had a look this morning and 134 were listened to in the last week. So if you do want some more ski chat to keep you going between seasons, there is plenty to listen to in our back catalogue. Just go to theskipodcast.com, search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find something of interest to you. Also in the stats, I saw that in the last week, 56% of our listeners were in the UK, 13% in the States, and that means the remaining 31% are listening from around the world. Disappointingly, although I found listeners in Turkey, Vietnam, and Japan, there were none in China. So maybe this episode will change this. And Justin can be added to that list. Although if you're using VPN, then people will never know.
Yes, I will be one of your listeners.
Wherever you are in the world listening to this podcast, thank you for joining us. You can follow me at Skipedia and the podcast at Ski Podcast. But for now, I'd like to thank Intersport for sponsoring the show and thank my guest today, Gabby. Thank you very much.
Delight. Thank you for hosting me.
And Justin, thank you.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
And finally, listener, thank you for joining us. And until next time, goodbye.